Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with co-host Russ Chinelli this week, and we're going to continue our sort of study into the area of physics. And today our guest is Dr. Carlos Salgado. He's from Norfolk State University in Virginia and is also part of the Jefferson Laboratory in Newport News, Virginia. And so, Carlos, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much.
We like to begin this show with getting a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of the guest. You know, what were your early sort of impressions of science? What attracted you to science? What got you into it? What got you into physics? So tell us a little bit about your early background.
Okay, yeah. I was born in Uruguay in South America. So the conditions there are kind of different than here in the way you study and how the studies are organized. And I guess most of the people think about go to study careers in some kind of profession like engineering, lawyer, medical doctors. And it never occurred to me that you can study a science. But I have been always, since I remember, very curious about nature. Like going on the top of the roof of my house at night and just being there watching the stars in the sky to move. And I actually can see them move around,
right,
you know, from east to west.
So you used to spend nights up on your roof.
That's correct.
Do you remember your first shooting star?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of shooting stars. That's a good thing, being also in Norway. And here in El Paso, you have similar skies, and there are not much light pollution.
Right.
So, you could see a lot of stars. And the southern sky, of course, Uruguay is the southern hemisphere. The southern sky is really very rich in stars, and you see the Milky Way all the way, like a wide spot in the sky,
right,
the center of Milky Way is on top of your head.
That sash of white.
That's right.
I mean, Uruguay is next to Chile, and Chile is renowned for having some of the best observatories in the world.
That's correct. There are a lot of observatories from all over the world. They go there, Europe, Russia,
right.
Even Russians went there and installed observatories because there are areas that are very dry and very dark.
So is astronomy a big deal in Uruguay?
Well, Uruguay is the high elevation is 600 meters. But it's very dark. There are very few people in the whole country, and there are not much industrial.
So the industrial lights don't bother you at night.
That's correct. So there's not much pollution. It's one of the greenest countries in the world, just to, to tell something about the country.
So they
sell like green tourists.
Oh, they do. Oh,
yeah,
like
they do.
Costa Rica, right.
That's right.
Well, that's a great way to attract people.
Right. It's a way to attract people that want to do that type of.
So how old were you when you began looking at the stars? Do you remember?
I don't remember. And I was lucky to have a neighbor also that was a Navy captain. Of course, the Navy people knew a lot about the stars. In all times, it was the way to move on sea. Right? And he had a small telescope. He invited me to use his telescope. And, of course, it was great. So look through the telescope.
So you remember Saturn's rings, the first time you saw those.
That's correct, yes. With a small telescope, right? But with a small telescope, you can discover a lot. Then the sky is much more than it looked like in your naked eye.
Right.
And that, I think, is the first step to be a scientist because you become curious. What is there that you cannot see? And that is a never-ending curiosity. When you start to be curious, you have to stop.
Right. But you mentioned earlier.
Asking questions.
Right. But you mentioned that you didn't see the career as scientist,
right?
I mean, so you
right because the situation, I didn't start from the beginning in engineering. That was the closest thing I can find because it has physics and I have mathematics.
Right,
but of course it's not the same than be a scientist, right? Because it's a more professional career to work in more technical aspects of application of that. But I was interested most in the basic questions about nature, right? But, yeah, I didn't know. I think this is a problem sometimes. People don't know that it can be a career to be a scientist. It's not just a hobby. You can actually have a career being
make a living.
Make a living.
Be on radio.
That's right.
So when you got your engineering degree, and you also got a physics degree, though, at the same
right,
time.
Right, so I started, but at the second year, I found out, being in the university already, there was a department of physics, and people were doing bachelor's in physics, and they can something called a PhD in physics, and I didn't know at the beginning, and in mathematics, and another science, right, and in astronomy. And then I started studying astrophysics in the Department of Astronomy at the same time that I was doing engineering. Because I always thought, and also, just in case, I have two careers. But, it's kind of tough, but they are related, of course. And the physics and mathematics help both ways. So I was doing both for that time.
And did you carry on at the same university for your PhD?
Yes. No, they don't have a PhD over there
okay.
at that time.
Right.
They do have now, but at that time the terminal degree is called licenciado. it's kind of a master type in astronomy. So I did my a thesis,
okay.
a master thesis, and that was it. It was no PhD at the time.
So where did you get your PhD and how did
I
that journey
unfold?
States.
Yeah, I came to the United States to continue to a PhD.
And where did you get it?
To Michigan State University.
Michigan
in
State.
Lansing, yes. Then, because I was interested in part of astrophysics that are related to what is called high-energy physics, that have to do with, in the sky we look at with our eye and we see light coming, but and there are other more stuff coming from the sky, something called cosmic rays. There are particles. There are like electrons, protons, and all types of particles. Most of these are protons because the universe is made of hydrogen, and hydrogen is protons mostly. They rain on us all the time. So
this is the so-called solar wind that we're talking about, or is that something slightly
solar
different?
Solar wind are some of these cosmic rays coming from the sun, but are also cosmic rays coming from all around the universe, and mostly from our galaxy. Not clear where they come from, some of them, because since are made of charged particles, when they go through magnetic fields, like a magnet, they deviate. So the good thing for the light, it doesn't do much of that. So a star light comes from the star, so you know where it is, because it comes in the direction where it was produced. Cosmic rays are coming from directions that are nowhere produced in that direction. So you don't know where they were produced because they are coming after they loop around places
to
you.
Interesting.
So it's very difficult to find out where are the places. Now, of course, since we know places that have the energy, because they have a lot of energy, some of this, and have to be related with a very energetic process that happen in the universe, like explosion of a star, right? Like we call it supernova, right? These are stars that explode and threw all the material out into the galaxy, and then our particles and then move around the magnetic field of the galaxy in loops over and over, and sometimes and some many of them hit us. And there are also, as you mentioned, particles coming from our sun, because the sun blows particles from the atmosphere of the sun all over the solar system, and it's called the solar wind. But they are less energetic than the other ones, the ones that come from supernovae, because supernovae is really a blow of the whole star in big pieces. So this produce very energetic. So, by the way, this is what the whole subject of particle physics started, by the way. We now use accelerators here on Earth to study the particle physics, but at the beginning, the first high-energy physicists that studied the particles, they are the pieces where matter is made of, were studying things going on balloons. They took the detectors and a balloon to very high altitudes. They were very brave because they were complicated detectors inside balloons, and they had to go.
And the people were with them?
And the people with them, yes.
Oh.
So not just the, yeah, no,
it was, no, it's just this, the not remote sensing. This is
so the first guy that he got the Nobel Prize for this in 1905. He did that because there were these rays. They found out that there were these particles coming, and they didn't know they were coming from Earth itself. As you know, the Earth produces also particles by radiation of natural decaying atoms, but there were some. They didn't know they come from the top or from the bottom, right? from the ground or from the space. So what they say, okay, let's go up in a balloon and see if the number of particles increases or decreases. So if it decreases, it will come from the bottom. If it increases, it will come from the top.
And they
found out that it increases.
Yeah. So. That's a classically simple experiment at
that
particular time.
And he got the Nobel Prize
was difficult. What was the name of the person?
Hess. For that, he got the Nobel Prize, for being very brave, because that was a dangerous thing.
For knowing the difference between up and down.
That's right.
So, anyway, you got your PhD, and then decided to start your own physics career, right?
That's correct. So my PhD actually was done in Michigan State, but in CERN. I think maybe some people have heard about it, because it's a high-energy accelerator in Geneva, Switzerland.
Isn't that where the God particle is?
The God particle called the Higgs have been discovered recently. And they have been very successful lately in discovering several particles that are important in our understanding of what matter is made of. They discovered something called the W and the Z in the 80s. And lately, they discovered the Higgs.
Right.
You see, they've been looking for many years, from the 80s until now. and right now it's the largest.
We have something that we call a standard model, which explains how all these particles fit together.
Right. So
is that going to survive?
Yes. It has to be. The standard model is something that we know it works perfectly, too perfectly, because in the last 10, 30 years, most of the work of high-energy physicists, these people that started with the cosmic rays, and now they're working with accelerators, then it's better because you can control which kind of particle you produce. They find there are many, many particles. And then what that happened, what you do is try to organize the particle in some kind of model. Because if you have many particles many times, it's because there are the combination of smaller basic elements. And that's what we found, that there's many, many, many particles, hundreds of them. Actually, natures tend to be simpler for some reason that we understand than the way we see in real, you know, with our eyes and our senses. So the standard model is the minimum that we have now to explain everything in the universe, and include quarks, leptons, and all this weird names invented by people but it's a short list of particles, but still we think that maybe it can be less than that.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russ Chianelli, and our guest today is an astrophysicist or a physicist studying astrophysics, Carlos Salgado from Norfolk State University. We'll be back in one brief moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neeson. Bats used to bear the unfair image that they were all bloodsuckers. Now, many appreciate that bats are invaluable in controlling the insect population and in pollination and seed dispersal.
Well, keep those in mind as we tell you what else bats are good at, as reservoirs for deadly viruses. That's right, everything from SARS to the Ebola virus and the new MERS virus, which is extremely deadly.
Now scientists are discovering just under half of all fruit bats in a dozen African countries also harbor the Hnipa viruses, which can be deadly to other animals and humans. A third of the bats also carry a rabies-like virus called the Lagos bat virus.
Researchers had tested more than 2,000 of the straw-colored fruit bats, which is the most widely distributed bat in Africa.
The concern is that the Hanipa viruses can be passed in bat urine and other bodily fluids, which means people living near bat populations are at risk. Outbreaks have killed horses and humans in Australia, as well as pigs and pig farmers in Malaysia.
Bats have maintained viruses since ancient times. They're a natural incubator since they can migrate long distances, live longer than 25 years, and hibernate, which keeps viruses alive.
Bats are constantly shedding viruses through urine and droppings, which easily infect other bats as they roost together in tight communities. But they're also essential to our ecosystem, so we can't consider eliminating them.
Scientists are focusing on developing vaccines and antivirals to protect people. It'll become increasingly important as humans continue to invade pristine ecosystems.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Dr. Carlos Salgado from Norfolk State University, who's really interested in this soup of particles that confuse those of us that don't follow this very carefully. But Russell is a bit of an expert on this, and I'm sure, Russell, you've got a question.
Yeah, I have a question because I remember when I became fascinated and got my degree and everything like that, we knew that the universe was expanding, contracting, you know, steady state. Now we know that's not true.
Right.
It's speeding up.
Right.
So how do we know that we really understand, for example, the Standard Model, and then in a few years something else will happen?
Well, the Standard Model is now even, we're trying to understand all matter, all everything around us. But when we extended our view of the universe to the universe is much, much larger than we thought it is, right? And this happened in the last 100 years. The universe has expanded in size, right, from our point of view, to something that is difficult to imagine. That it takes billions of years for the light to travel at a speed that for us here, it seems instantaneously, like 180,000 miles per second, right? But it takes billions of years to travel to the limit that we can see. And with our more powerful telescope. And of course, we don't know if we're reaching the limits of what the universe is.
But it's speeding up.
Well, it's expanding. And that's hard to understand.
But it's going faster, no?
And it's expanding faster. That's correct. Let me connect what the Standard Model is. The Standard Model is this, we say now that the elementary particles at this moment, the basic elements that we cannot distinguish nothing inside them, there are a few particles we call quarks, and we call electrons and muons and tau electron. Okay? So there are six quarks and six of the leptons of type of electrons, so 12. So there are a few. Now, unfortunately, we find out, because of this expansion of looking at the whole universe, that this is only what constitutes about 4% of the whole universe. The rest of the universe is made of something else that we don't have idea what it is.
Which may be contracting just at the same speed that part is expanding.
What is expanding is more complicated than that, because all these particles are inside space. Right? There is a basic thing that we treat like a thing, because we never...
So now we get into this dimensionality.
Right, because we never... Einstein started thinking about space like a thing, like something. Because we always put things like quarks inside the space. But the space was the place where we put things. But it didn't have its own soul, let's say.
Yes. Yeah.
But Einstein thought that that hub is like a thing, the space itself, that can have a structure, like
dimensions.
It has dimension, but also can be curved, twisted, can be, have shapes. It's just not an empty, I'm talking about the emptiness, right? The nothing, where you don't have something where you put things right. before you put things. So that's hard to understand. And, of course, that's what math help us, because we follow the logic behind connections, right? Because science is mostly make connections, logic connection between things in a way that maybe we can relate to everyday experience sometimes. And that's what happened with these theories. And that was hard to visualize with the experience we have, because we never experience the farthest reaches of the universe as we never experience the farthest inner reaches of the atom. We know. So we don't have any picture in our minds of that. So when you say, oh, I understand something because I have a picture in my mind of how that can work, it doesn't work here. What you have to follow is your logic written in mathematical form. So that's why you have to, unfortunately, sometimes learn mathematics.
But that poses an incredible problem for mankind, that there's just a few, what I call the priests of mathematics, who right. can define what this is. And yes. the rest of us have to simply say, well, we bow to your superior knowledge.
No, I don't think it's true. You need this mathematics and the logic to come to these ideas. And then you have to make it possible for people to understand the general idea, even not so deeply as the expert, of course. The expert will understand more of the details of what, because all these ideas have some details, and sometimes they are not perfect, right? There are all imperfections in all these models. Right. As I say, this standard model can be improved. Everything can be improved, because always a model of what reality is.
Well, help and some of our people out here are listening to this, okay?
Like Keith.
That when we talk about standard model and all that stuff, it only applies to 4 or 4.5% of the material that we know.
That's right.
The other 95% unknown, dark matter.
There are dark energy and dark matter.
How do we know that there's dark energy and dark matter?
Dark matter, we know pretty well there is dark matter, because dark matter, we see it in a way that how they affect other objects. We don't see it directly, but it's like we see that it's there by the effect that produces in another thing. Following the laws of physics that we know that works on Earth, and the amazing thing is that they work all over these universes that we see, then these same laws of physics work everywhere.
Anybody challenge that concept?
Well,
because the laws of physics work where we see them, does it mean that it works in places that we've got no clue about, as you've just been talking about?
Well, yes, of course. The work of a scientist is to challenge everything.
Yes.
That's the work of the scientist. And, scientists are always challenging other scientists' work. And the best thing that you can do is have a great established theory and prove that it's wrong. So you will be famous.
Right.
So there are always proposing experiments to challenge. Because if you have an experiment and prove again and again this theory is right and right and right, okay, this is one more experiment than did that.
Or consistent, at least,
That's
if not
correct.
Right.
Right. It's consistent with what we observe.
Yes.
Of course, observations. So an observation is a measurement done by an instrument that always have errors. So all of the observations have limitations caused by the errors in the instrument that we use to do these observations. So things that are right one time are wrong in another time if we have better instrumentation. And that it does have to do with the technology. And the technology is getting better with time. Our instrumentation is getting better with time, and then the measurements are better with time.
But what about the speed of light? Didn't CERN measure a different, slightly different speed of light in CERN?
And also, some experiment can be straight or really wrong. Everybody can make mistakes, and physicists sometimes have done big mistakes, even collaboration of many physicists.
I mean, that actually is a very interesting point for the listeners to bear in mind, that the cutting edge of most topics, whether it be materials or it be physics, whether it be anything, that there's such a pressure that people think they've got a new result that in fact changes the paradigm, that they often get out there and they're ahead of their time. They haven't done all of the homework. Right. I mean, and sometimes you hear them talking about it on the radio, for goodness sake, before correct. They've even published. So there is this pressure because scientists are human. We're the same social makeup as everybody else.
Right. No, that's correct. And there are a lot of pressures into even funding pressures
right.
to produce things. Now, science is a very social, you know, think that scientists are, you know, working in the lab, you know, and getting some results from their minds they're thinking about or because they did an experiment. It's not true at all. Science, you know, it's sometimes difficult to define science. What it is, or the scientific method altogether, compared with other type of what is scientific and what is not scientific. But I like one definition of science, and it's a social consensus of what something happened. So when a scientist discovers, they have to convince the whole community of scientists that this is true.
I'm laughing at this because Russell has a big issue that he hates this word consensus, right?
Well,
I mean, as it comes to global warming.
Well,
anyway.
It's the right. same thing. There was this guy that invented the telescope, mm-hmm. and the consensus said, you're going to die because we are at the center of the universe on Earth. That telescope right. is bad. That's the consensus.
Well, that wasn't the consensus of scientists. That was the consensus of theologians.
So, well, we have the global warming theologians now.
You have them. It's a figment of Russell's imagination. Now, carry on, Carlos. I'm sorry.
Well, let me follow my point because that's where I'm going. Consensus is very hard to achieve. So in science, the thing that you have the experimental part to figure out what is right and wrong. And you have to confront always this with reality in some way, with measurements. Now, unfortunately, measurements have errors too. As I say, the errors change with time. But there are things that have been proved over and over. So people use it over and over for hundreds of years. So we know that works for a given aspect of the reality, not for all. We use, you know, what's called Newton's laws that were discovered by Newton a few hundred years ago. And they're right. We use it for going to the moon, buildings, bridges, civil engineers all the time, architects. Now, okay, physicists, they say, oh, they are wrong for some other aspects, right? So, for example, if you study this particle that we were talking before, we cannot use Newton's law. They don't apply there. So we have different theories that apply to this part of physics. So there are realms of reality explained by different theories.
You're an experimental person in the sense that you use observatories, you use data that
right.
you collect, but you're a theoretician. But you have a big group, right? I mean,
yes.
if you think of one of your projects, how many people working on the project?
Yeah, hundreds.
And,
right.
and so
yeah.
a lot of your time then is dealt dealing with these hundreds of people.
That's correct, yes. Yes, it's a very social, yes, and meetings and organizing people. And
Carlos, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio.
You're
it's
welcome.
Fascinating
welcome.
Insight, and
we
appreciate it. Thank
a
you.
A pleasure to be here, thank you.
Yes, please come back and explain quantum entanglement to us.
I see, okay.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And we will be back next week. Thank you for listening. My name's Keith Pannell. Bye-bye.
I'm Nomi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. University Medical Center of El Paso released findings that said while the hospital was compliant with the law, changes are still recommended to its policies when it comes to body searches. Findings come on the heels of a lawsuit filed against the hospital in December for conducting a body cavity search on a woman who is in Border Patrol custody. Read more at mcasynapse.org.